so. Yesterday we went through the meaning of the title, the homage by the translator. And then we started on the explanation of the main body of the sutra and talked about the background, the common background, what everybody could see, the uncommon background. And then we started to get into the actual juicy part, the actual meaning of the sutra, which had Shariputra's question to Avalokiteshvara, and then Avalokiteshvara's answer, which was intended for those, the first part of the answer is intended for those on the path of accumulation, the path of preparation, so the lower level bodhisattvas. And so we talked about his answer in brief. So now we're going to start with the extensive response on how to practice the perfection of wisdom that on the paths of accumulation and paths of preparation that Avalokiteshvara gave to Shariputra. So this section has the meditation on what's called the four profundities of the aggregate of form. So actually it goes through all of the aggregates, but we start with the aggregate of form, where it says form is empty, emptiness is form, emptiness is not other than form, form also is not other than emptiness. So there's four profundities there. So the first one's the profundity of the ultimate, and that's in the line form is empty. The second is the profundity of the conventional, and that's the line emptiness is form. And then the profundity of the two truths being the same nature or the same entity, that's in the lines emptiness is not other than form, form also is not other than emptiness. So those two lines. And then the fourth profundity, the profundity of the two truths being nominally distinct or nominally different, is implied by those last two lines, that emptiness is not other than form, form also is not other than emptiness. Okay, so now we're going to get, those are the four profundities, so we're going to go into depth with those. So let's start with the first one, the profundity of the ultimate. So here, we're talking specifically about the aggregate of form. As we go on, you know, it talks about feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, and consciousness. Those five are what's called the five aggregates, and they are what compose us. So the form aggregate refers to our body, okay? The feeling aggregate, our feelings of, you know, pain and pleasure. The discrimination aggregate is what helps us discern one object from another. The consciousness aggregate are our primary consciousnesses, you know, visual, auditory, olfactory, gustatory, tactile, and mental. Okay, just the primary things of being able to engage with those spheres of objects. And then the compositional factors are all the other mental factors that help, you know, that give context and cohesion to our all of our perceptions. So all the, you know, the various emotions and things like that. When we studied Lohrig, the mind and mental factors, yeah, we had 51 mental factors. So, you know, one is feeling, one is discrimination, the other 49 go in compositional factors. Okay? So, the five aggregates also is another way of describing them, where they talk about all phenomena. So we could think of them as being the five aggregates upon which we give the label I when we're talking about our person, but there's another way of speaking about them where the five aggregates includes everything. Okay, so let's start with form is empty. Okay, so form can refer to our body when we're speaking of the five aggregates of a person, or form can refer to, you know, visual objects, sounds, smells, tastes, touch, tactile objects, things like that. Okay, those are all considered form. So when we say that the aggregate of form is the profundity of the ultimate, this is talking about the emptiness of inherent existence of form. Okay? So it's profound because it's difficult to realize, and it's profound because realizing it leads us to liberation. And it's also profound because emptiness is the ultimate nature, the deeper level or deeper mode of existence of all phenomena. Okay, so when we talk about it here, we're going to be talking according to the Prasangika Madhyamika school. There's very philosophical tenets within Buddhism, and there's not enough time to go into all of them, but basically the Prasangika Madhyamika is the supreme or the most accurate of the philosophical tenets, so we'll be talking according to that one. Okay, the reason form is mentioned here also is because in the longer Prajnaparamita Sutra, there's 108 objects that are mentioned as being empty, and they go from form to omniscience. And there's 106 between form and omniscience, okay? So you start with a form, body, go all the way to omniscience. Everything, all this, is empty, okay? So here we're just dealing with a condensation of that, but it always starts with form. Okay, so form is empty of what? Okay, it's empty of something. Emptiness does not mean non-existence. It's empty of something. Okay, so we say form is empty of true existence, it's empty of inherent existence, it's empty of existing from its own side. So all these terms from the point of view of Prasangika Madhyamika are synonymous. So true existence means that something exists as it appears to us. Okay, inherent existence means that you can find it when you analyze, under ultimate investigation. Existing from its own side means that its existence is established from the side of the object, completely independent from any kind of apprehending consciousness. So although these terms have different definitions, they're all getting to the same point. Okay? And so this is actually recognizing what form is empty of. When we talk, this is we have to recognize it's called the object to be refuted or the object to be negated, the thing that form is empty of. And that's actually one of the hardest things in the whole meditation, because we are so used to seeing things as truly existent or inherently existent that we never question our perception, and we can't even think. We don't have the foggiest idea of what things are empty of, because we believe so much that things exist as they appear to us. So also, when we talk about this, we talk about the object to be negated or the object to be refuted in the emptiness meditation. This refers to inherent existence, true existence, existence from its own side, these things. These things never existed. Okay, so it's not that true existence existed and then we do the emptiness meditation and we get rid of true existence. True existence has never existed. It's a false projection of our mind onto phenomena. Okay, so we're not eliminating, by when we're realizing emptiness, we're not changing how phenomena exist, because they've always been empty. It's not like they've been true existence and true existent. When we realize emptiness, they become empty. They've always been empty, okay? So the object to be negated is something that is non-existing, but that we are fooled and think it exists, okay? So you have the object to be negated, true existence. Then you have another thing called the concept of true existence, or the grasping at true existence. Okay, or sometimes it's called the self-grasping ignorance. Lots of different, ways of putting this. Okay, this concept or this grasping at true existence is part of our mind. It's something that exists. It's a mental factor. Okay, so what it grasps at is something that is non-existent, because true existence is non-existent. But the concept that does the grasping is something that exists, because our mind has that concept and it latches onto things. Okay? So also, when we talk about the concept of true existence or the self-grasping, it's not just this thought thinking intellectually, because we think concept is just like some kind of something from our eyebrows up, you know, where we think, well, everything's truly existent. It's not like that. This is such a deep-rooted concept that we don't even realize it as a concept. We think that this is just the way things are. We don't even realize that we're conceptualizing, okay? So we have the concept of inherent existence or true existence that and that exists, and we're trying to free ourselves from that, because that self-grasping ignorance is what makes samsara go round. What it grasps at, inherent existence, is something that never has existed and never will exist. Okay, so when we talk about emptiness, okay, emptiness is what's called a non-affirming negative. Yeah, which there are positive phenomena, like the cup. The cup's a positive phenomena. There's something there, okay? There's things that are negative a negation, a negative phenomena. So those are absences of things. Now, there are some negative phenomena that imply something else. Okay, like if you say, you know, the fat person doesn't eat at nighttime, it implies that he eats during the day. So it's a negative statement saying he doesn't eat at night, but because he's fat, you know, he eats during the day. So that's called an affirming negative. Emptiness is a non-affirming negative. In other words, it simply negates something and it doesn't affirm anything positive in its place. So emptiness is simply negating this true existence. It's simply the absence of true existence. There's nothing positive in its place. Okay? So when we're trying to realize emptiness, we're not trying to realize some positive phenomena out there. Okay? But what we're doing in the meditation on emptiness is we have our idea of how things are existing, and we check and see if they exist that way. We find that they don't, and what we're left with is the lack of them existing in the way we thought they did. And nothing else is implied. It's just a total lack of all of our fantasized projections on phenomena regarding how they exist. So that's why it's called a non-affirming negation. So it's not like we're looking emptiness as some positive thing out there to grasp at. Okay, nothing is implied. It's simply the absence of inherent existence. Okay, and so while the emptiness is a non-affirming negation, okay, it's also a permanent phenomenon. In other words, it doesn't change from moment to moment because it's an absence. It's a negative phenomena. So it's permanent. It doesn't change from moment to moment. And it's also, this emptiness isn't something created by our meditation. Yeah? It's something that is the basic nature of phenomena that we've never realized before. Okay? Now, the wisdom that realizes emptiness is something that we do create and enhance by practicing the path. And the wisdom realizing emptiness is a consciousness, and it's a positive phenomena, and it's something we're trying to develop and strengthen. And it's the subjective mind that realizes the object, which in this case is emptiness. Okay? So we had the concept of inherent existence. Its object was inherent existence, which is something that doesn't exist at all. We have the wisdom realizing emptiness, its object is emptiness, which is emptiness is something that exists, but it's a non-affirming negative. It's the complete absence of inherent existence. Okay, that's what we're trying to realize. Okay, now there's a whole variety of different meditations that you can do to realize emptiness. We'll just deal with one of them here. It's called the four-point analysis, and it's a very kind of precise and good one for getting at the meaning of emptiness. So it has 4 points. The first one is identifying the object to be negated. Okay. The second point is called establishing the pervasion. The third point is seeing that things are not inherently the same or not inherently one. And the fourth point is seeing that things are not inherently different or not inherently many. Okay? So the hardest of this four-point analysis is the first point, identifying the object to be negated. So the object to be negated is inherent existence. Okay? And like I said, we're so used to inherent existence appearing to us, and we're so used to assenting to that appearance and grasping it, that it's very hard for us to identify what is actually the thing that we're trying to prove to ourselves doesn't exist, because it never has existed. Okay? So it's kind of like, to use an example, it's like we've been born with sunglasses on. We're so used to being seeing everything dark that if somebody comes along and says, you know, everything you're seeing is dark, we say, no, it isn't, because we've never seen anything any other way. Okay? So that's kind of like us. You know, we perceive everything as inherently existent. Somebody comes along and says they aren't, and we go, huh? You know? No, this is just the way they are. Okay? So that this is why it's difficult. So how do we get some kind of an idea about what inherent existence is? Okay? Inherent existence means that something has some essence from its own side. Okay? It has something in it that makes it it, independent of any other phenomena. Okay? So like when we look at the flower, okay? We look at the flower and it looks like from, I mean, when we look at the flower, how does it look like? It's the flower, doesn't it? It looks, there's just a flower here. It's no big deal. There's a flower. Okay? So we look at this flower and it's like it has some nature inside of it that makes it a flower. I mean, it's not a grapefruit. It's not a giraffe. Why? Because it has the nature of flowerness. That's how it appears to us, isn't it? You know? It just has that nature of being a flower. It's radiating out flowerness to us. Completely independent of our mind. We just happened to kind of walk in the room and saw this flower. You know, it exists out here as this object, completely external to us. Isn't that how it appears? Completely unrelated to me. External object out there, unrelated to me, unrelated to its parts, unrelated to anything that caused it. It's just this flower that's out there existing completely under its own power, from its own side, making itself go. That's how it appears to us. Right? Okay? Now, if it really existed the way that it appeared, then we should be able to find the thing that is the flower, because it appears to have the essence of flowerness. Okay? So if it existed like that, we should be able to find the thing that is the flower. Now, the second point is the pervasion, establishing the pervasion. There's only two places to look for the flower. We've either got to find the flower inside its parts, or we've got to find the flower separate from its parts, right? Is there any third place where it could be? You know, we're looking for this essence of flowerness. It's either got to be here, you know, in these parts, in this thing, or it's got to be something completely removed. There's no other possibility. So that's the second point. There's only two places to look for it. Okay? So if there's this solid, concrete essence of flowerness, object, objective entity out there, there's only two places to look at it. In its parts or separate from its parts. Okay? That's the second point. Third point is we're going to look in its parts. So we start looking and looking because it looks like there's a flower in here. Doesn't it? You know, otherwise, why would we come in the room and say it's flower? Because it's there, you know, there's got to be a flower in there. So we start looking, you know, and we start going through the flower, you know. Is this the flower? What do you think? Hello? It's a petal. How about this? Another petal. How about this? Okay. Now, if we went through, I'm not going to take this all apart, but, you know, if we took it all apart, what would we have out here? Bunch of petals, wouldn't we? When the bunch of petals are there, do you have a flower? You don't have a flower. What happened to the flower? But wait a minute. But what? You know, I mean, what happened to this flower? You know, I mean, it looks like there's something here that's flower, doesn't it? That's radiating out flower quality from its own side. But when we go through and we examine all the parts and we deconstruct it, we can't find a thing that is the flower. All we find are parts. We find a lot of petals. We find stamens. We find, you know, whatever, pistils, whatever these all things are. I forget from biology class. But that's all we find there. What we find is non-flower, isn't it?
You find parts.
You find parts, but but each part is not a flower, is it? It's a part, okay? But a part isn't a flower. A part is different than the flower. A part is a part of a flower. A petal is a part of a flower. A petal isn't a whole flower. I mean, if I gave you 12 dozen of these and said, happy birthday, you're going to go, come on. You know, because this isn't a flower, it's a petal. Okay? So when we look to find the thing that is the flower essence, we can't find it. All we find are non-flowers, because each part is a non-flower. Okay? So, then, if we look in all these parts and we can't find a flower, okay? Again, the collection of the parts is not a flower, because if you have all the petals put there, you still don't have a flower. And because each petal is a non-flower, so how can you put a bunch of non-flowers together and get a flower? You can't. It's impossible. It's like putting a bunch of apples together and getting an orange. Okay? So the collection of all the petals isn't the flower. And if we look for the flower somewhere else besides here in the petals and pistils and stamen, can we find the flower anywhere else? Is the flower over there? The flower up there. You know, the flower isn't something separate from its parts, but also it isn't in its parts either. Is it? So somehow we've been fooled, because when we look at the flower, it looks like there's a flower right there in its parts. But when we examine to find the flower, we can't find it. Yeah? But if you start, you know, you start looking at everything, yeah? Like we say, I have a body, yeah? My body, you know, we look, my body appears so real, doesn't it? My body. Body is this solid, concrete thing. You know, where's my body? We say, here it is. Here's my body. This is my body. It's one real thing, and it's something very precious we've got to protect because it's this one solid, concrete thing, okay? But then you start analyzing, you know, well, what exactly is my body? You know, it's radiating out essence of body, okay? I mean, because we don't question it. We walk in the room, we see body. It's there. Why do we see body? Because it seems to us like there's a body out there from its own side, completely independent of everything else. So if it existed that way, we should be able to find the thing that's the body. When we start doing that with our body, okay, is this my body? This is an arm. It's not my body. If my arm were my body, then, you know, all you could do is have an arm in the room and you'd say, there's the body. You don't do that, do you? When there's an arm, you just say, there's an arm. The arm isn't the body. Okay, is this, you know, is my head my body? It's just a head. Okay, if my head were there, you wouldn't say there's the body. Okay, so then we start thinking, well, this is the body. Okay, well, what about, you know, your chest or your abdomen? Is that your body? Well, no, that isn't either, because if you just had that, okay, is the skin your body? Are your intestines your body? You know, where's this thing that seems like it's my body, this one solid, singular, concrete thing that I've got to protect. When we start looking for body, all we find are a bunch of parts. Okay? We don't find a body. We find parts of a body. There's difference between the parts and the body, aren't there? Because there's many parts and there's only one body. If the body were the parts, then because there's many parts, we should have many bodies. Or if because there's one body, then we should only have one part. If the parts were the body, they should be at the same in number. But they're not. There's many parts, there's only one body. And when we go through all the parts, we can't find the body. Okay? That doesn't mean that there's no body that exists. Okay? Because we've been looking for the thing that is the body. We've been looking for this independently existent body, this essence, this body that has an essence independent of all phenomena. When we look for that thing that is the body on it from its own accord, we can't find that. Okay? So we say that things are empty. Like we would say the body is empty of being an inherently existent body. It's empty of inherent existence. That doesn't mean that there's no body there at all. Okay? There is a body. Okay? Now, how does that body exist that is there? Well, it doesn't exist because it has the essence of bodiness. Because we've already looked for that essence. It doesn't, that essence doesn't exist. The body exists simply because we had all these things which are non-bodies. The arms, the legs, the intestines, the kidneys, the skin, the hair, the nails. All these things that are not bodies, that are only parts. All these things come together. That still isn't a body. Okay? Because it doesn't become a body until we look at it and we have a thought that this is a thing. And when our mind makes it into a thing and then we give it a name. After we give it a name, then it's become a body. Before we give it the name, you know, there's just these bunch of parts and there's no body that appears from its own side. So the body exists because our minds have the concept of all these parts coming together to make an object, and we give that object a name. But, you know, if we look at the body in another way, like we could look at the body and say, here's one thing. We could also look at the body and say, here's many things, couldn't we? What makes the difference whether this thing is one or many? Is it one or many from its own side? No, it's only one body or many things like arms and legs and intestines. Only that only depends on our concept and name, doesn't it? Doesn't it? It only depends on how we look at it. You know, if our mind puts all these things together, it becomes one thing and we give that one thing one label. If our mind looks at it as separate things, it becomes many phenomena and we give them all different labels. So none of these things have existence from their own side. They all depend on being that because our mind looks at them and gives them a label. Okay? So that's what we mean when we say that things exist by being merely labeled. They don't exist from their own side, naturally independent of our mind, but they exist by being merely labeled. Now, the thing that causes the problem is that our mind put them together to make it an object. We gave it a label, and then we forgot about that, and we started to think that the thing that was labeled was appearing from the side of the object. So my mind, you know, took all these things together that appear, you know, all these petals together. My mind connected the dots, didn't it? Yeah, because these are just petals, separate things. My mind connected the dots, gave it the name flower. But then I forgot that, you know, it's my concept and my mind and the label that made this into a flower. And when I see flower after that, it seems like there's flower radiating from the side of this thing. Okay? So the thing that's radiating from its side that seems independent of our participation in conceiving of it as an object and giving it a label, that's the inherently existent thing. And we can see that that doesn't exist. And another way to look at it, and get this idea of mental labeling, is, you know these Escher paintings? I really need to get a book of Escher paintings when I teach emptiness. You know? And you know how you look at them, and sometimes you look at them and, like, you see a lizard, and you look at the exact same painting and you see, you know, a porcupine? Okay, it's the exact same lines, isn't it? Okay, you look at it, you pick out some lines, and your mind joins them together and sees them as one thing and gives them a name, and then you have lizard. And then after that, it seems, when you look like it, like lizards coming out from you from the side of the painting, doesn't it? But you look at the same painting and the same lines in a slightly different way, and you see porcupine, or whatever it is, something else, you know? And you see porcupine, and you only see porcupine because your mind connected those lines in a certain way, conceived of them in a certain way, and gave it a name. But, you know, from the side of the painting, it's not like the lizard exists from there or the porcupine exists from there. We only perceive both of them because of our mind connecting the dots, connecting the parts and giving it a label. But then we forget that our mind conceived of those things and made them into an object, and instead we think that it's appearing from the side of the object. Okay? So that's the mistaken thing that we have. That's the appearance of true existence. You know, that it's appearing from the side of the object, completely independent of us. You know? It's the same like with letters. You have the letter A. Actually, you know, what's the letter A? It's just three lines. Yeah? If you're somebody who grew up in, you know, I don't know, some other country, and you come here and you see these three lines, do you see the letter A? You don't. You know, you don't see the letter A until somebody says, hey, look at these three lines. They're together and we call that A. Okay? After that, then you have the concept and you have the label. And after that, it seems like A appears from the side of the letter coming back to you. But actually, you can see that there's nothing there from the side of the letter that is A, because before you knew the name and had the concept, there wasn't an A appearing to you. There are just three lines. Okay? So this is what we mean by things are merely, they exist by being merely labeled, and they're empty of inherent existence. Okay? So there is a body here. But that body exists by being merely labeled. But when you search for it to find the thing that is the body, you can't find it. All you find is the total absence of any kind of solid, concrete body. When you search for the body, all you find is the lack of an inherently existent body. That's the emptiness. Okay? So emptiness doesn't mean non-existence. It just means empty of inherent existence, empty of this fantasized projection of existence that we've put onto phenomena. In the same way, when we say nominal existence, you know, things that exist by being merely labeled by term and concept, that is the only way in which things exist. They only exist in a nominal way. They don't exist independently. They don't exist from their own side. They only exist nominally. Okay, but nominal existence, even though if you analyze and try and find that object that is that thing, you can't find it, nominal existence, when you don't analyze, is sufficient, and that's the only level of existence there is. Our mistake is we're not satisfied with nominal existence, and we make everything concrete. Because we make it concrete, we experience problems. Okay? Okay, so what we're trying to do here is realize that there's the emptiness and there's the nominal existence, or the dependent arising. Okay, those two things exist. What does not exist are what's called the two extremes. One extreme is saying nothing whatsoever exists. And the other extreme is saying inherent existence. Things are there from their own side with their own essence. Okay? So when we talk about the Buddha teaching the middle way, the middle way means that it's not non-existent and it's not inherently existent. Okay? And middle way doesn't mean it's somewhere like it's half existent, it's half non-existent and half inherent existence. Middle way doesn't mean that. Okay? Middle way means it's not non-existent and it's not inherently existent. Okay? But what is it? It's empty and it's nominally existent. It's empty and it's a dependent arising. Okay? So, if we're going to meditate on this, what we want to do is first identify the object to be negated, and then with an analytical mind, start searching for it. If that thing, that solid concrete thing was really there, I should be able to find it. It's either got to be in its parts or separate from its parts. And so you start to analyze. So you check all through its parts looking for it. You can't find it. You check everything else separate from its parts. You can't find it. Then you know for sure it just plain old doesn't exist. Okay? So through your analytical mind, you've come upon the meaning of emptiness. When you have that emptiness, it's kind of like, wow, everything that you thought was so solid all of a sudden vaporizes. Okay? It's the lack of what you thought was solid, that emptiness. Then you discovered that through the analytical mind. Then you stay on that emptiness with your stabilizing meditation. Okay? So in this way, you combine the analytical meditation and the stabilizing meditation. So you use the analytical meditation to get yourself to understand, how things exist, that they're empty. When you have that, then you stay on that emptiness. You focus on that emptiness single-pointedly with your placement meditation. Okay? Now, when we first realize emptiness, like I was saying, we do it with, there's an inferential understanding. So it's basically what's happening is we have a mental image of emptiness. Okay? So when we first meditate, we have a mental image of emptiness. Still, that's good enough, So we focus on that single-pointedly. As we meditate more and more, then the mental image of emptiness fades away and you get to the actual direct perception of emptiness. And then you focus on that with stabilizing meditation. But that's going to take a bit of practice, okay? So, we need to just begin by understanding the stuff that is at an intellectual level and then start to play with it and apply it to the things that we see around us. Okay? So here, we're talking about form. Form is empty, things like that. Remember when we were saying that they meditate on the emptiness of inherent existence of the five aggregates also, and that also referred to the emptiness of inherent existence of the person or the self? This is the one that really creates our problem, is our grasping at an inherently existent person or self. Because we have this feeling of this me in here. Okay, don't we? Yeah. There's this very strong feeling of a me. I am here. I am this separate entity. My name is so-and-so. I am this separate entity. I want to be happy. I don't want to suffer. My reputation is incredibly important. There's this very strong feeling of being this separate, independent entity, isn't there? And when we look at everybody else, it seems like they are independent, separate entities also. Okay? And it looks like the self or the person is somewhere mixed in with the body and mind. But it's also a little bit distinct from the body and mind. So when we have this appearance of the inherent existence of the person, it appears mixed in with the aggregates of the body and mind. But it's also, it's mixed in, but it's not quite exactly the same. Okay? But we have this very, and our feeling of I, You know, our feeling of I, when we feel it, it feels like it's mixed in here with the body and mind, doesn't it? But when we just think I, we don't think particularly of body or of mind, do we? So it's appearing mixed in with the body and mind, but it's also appearing slightly separate. Yeah? So this is the one to really check, because we have the solid, concrete feeling of me, you know. Especially, you know, a very good way to make the object of to be negated appear vividly is think about your reputation. Yeah? And think about somebody criticizing you, you know. Or think about somebody, you know, telling you off or rejecting you or, you know, pushing you away. You know how that feeling of I comes up at that time? That's the object to be negated. Okay? So you get that feeling to arise. It's sometimes quite a painful feeling, isn't it, you know? Yeah. Or it could also be when you have strong attachment. You know, I really want this. I really want this. You know, the eye that really wants that. Look at that eye, how that eye appears to exist. Okay? So here, we're just trying to get a feeling of the eye. So you don't just sit there and recite these words. The eye appears mixed in with the aggregates, but yet separate from it. Because that doesn't, you know, that's great, you know. You have a definition, but you're completely out of touch with your own feeling. So what you're trying to do is get that, you know, that feeling of the eye, get it worked up, and just feel it, you know. What does this eye feel like? What's this feeling, you know, of this strong me there, you know? Like, or when you feel shame, you know. I mean, when you feel completely like shame or, you know, whatever it is, you know, that strong feeling of me, it's right there, isn't it? Okay? So then you check. If there were that thing that's me, you know, if it were there, it's got to be either mixed in with the body and mind or it's got to be separate from the body and mind. There's no other place where I could be. If I'm looking for me, I've either got to be in this thing or separate from it. Okay? Now, clearly, we're not separate from our body and mind, are we? Okay? You don't have the body and mind here and say, children's across the room. You know, if you do, you know where they put you. Okay? So, you know, it's real clear to us that who we are isn't something separate from the body and mind. You know, there isn't some kind of soul or thing that's separate from the body and mind that's me, because what is that thing? It's got to have a definition. Well, we say, oh, well, I am the thing that thinks. Well, that's the mind. Okay? So we're back to looking in the body and mind for the self. So then you start looking through the body and mind. You have this very strong feeling of me. Okay? So you start looking through your body. Okay? And you start, you know, is this me? Is this me? There's this strong feeling of me somewhere. So you start going through your body and you start trying to catch that feeling of me wherever it is in your body and see if you can catch it and find me. Okay? But when you do that, what do you find? When you go through your body, do you find me? All you find are lungs and intestines and kidneys and stuff like that. You know, there seems to be this I in here, but if we look in the body, we can't find one part of the body that's me. You know, even we say, my brain is me. Well, you know, if my brain were out there, would you say hello, children? I don't think so. Yeah. I mean, my brain isn't me. It's a brain. It's not me. Okay. So then we say, okay, well, I'm not my body. I must be my mind. So then we start looking through all the conscious parts of us. You know, am I the thing that perceives visual things? Am I the things that hear? Am I the things that, you know, smells? You know, and then we usually go, oh, I'm the one who thinks. Well, look, where's that thinker? Who's that thinker? What are you thinking? Yeah? Is the thinker the one who thinks nice thoughts or the one who thinks awful thoughts? Because those are two different thinkers, aren't they? Or you say, I'm my emotions, like we identify. I'm this angry person. Well, are you your anger? Yeah? If there's pure anger out there, do you say, hi, Sam? You don't. Anger is just anger. Anger isn't the person. So we start going through each and every one of our emotions, each and every one of our thoughts.
And it looks like there's an I there somewhere. But again, we can't find it. Okay? So this thing, this we had this feeling of this strong feeling of I who we've got to protect. But when we look for that thing that is the I, all we find are parts of the body, parts of the mind, and nothing else. You know, we don't find anything else. We search, we can't find something that is the self. Okay? So we stay in that not finding of the self. So you stay in that non-finding. Okay? Now, does that mean that there's no person altogether? No, it doesn't mean that. There are persons. Okay? We're all sitting here in this room. People exist. But how do people exist? They don't exist from their own side with their own nature, with their own solid, concrete personality and thing that makes them them. All there is this accumulation of parts of the body and aspects of the mind. And on top of that, we give it the label so-and-so. But apart from the accumulation of these things and our mind looking at it and giving it that label, apart from that, there's no other self or person. There's no independent thing that is the self. Okay? And this is real tricky because our feeling of self is so strong. I mean, it really feels like there's somebody in there running the show, doesn't there? If we don't feel like, you know, the self is just something labeled on top of the body and mind, we don't feel that way. We feel like there's an I in there. I am making decisions. I am in control. Yeah? I'm running the show. I'm perceiving this. I'm doing that. But when we look for that I, we can't find it. Okay? So there's nothing in there that's running the show, that's there from its own side. However, there is a nominally existent self or I that exists simply because you have these parts together and our mind connects the dots and gives it the label with a name, you know, whoever you are. That's all. Okay? There's no other person there besides one that exists by being merely labeled. You know, I mean, sit with that for a while. You know, there's no person there besides the one that's merely labeled. So whose reputation is at stake? You know, who is so terrified of things? You know, who is this failure? You know, when you look, you can't find. You can't find. Okay? There's these feelings. There's the feeling of terror. There's the feeling of attachment to reputation. There's the feeling of whatever. But these things are not us. They're just feelings, aren't they? They're just emotions. They aren't who we are. So who is it that's feeling these emotions? Try and find the one that's feeling the emotions. Try and find the one that feels so endangered. Okay? So that's what we're getting at with this first profundity, that things are empty of inherent existence. Then, second profundity. Where are we? Where did the second profundity go here? Okay. Can't find it, can I? Okay. So the second, third, and fourth profundities are all talking about the conventional nature of form. The first profundity was talking about the ultimate nature, how, you know, its deeper mode of existence. The second, third, and fourth profundities are all talking about its subtle conventional nature. So the second profundity, when we say emptiness is form, okay, that phrase, what we're getting at is that it's talking about form being a manifestation of emptiness. Okay? In other words, it's talking about form being a mere appearance and form existing by mere name, by being merely named. Okay? So this is part of the conventional nature of form. Okay, so here we have to talk a little bit about
ultimate truth and conventional truth and, you know, discriminate between these a little bit, okay? So, I'll give you definitions. They won't necessarily make sense at the beginning, okay? When we talk about conventional truth, the literal translation is like truth for a concealer or truth for an obscurer. In other words, conventional truth refers to all phenomena except emptiness, and these are things that appear true to an obscured mind. Okay? So, a truth for a concealer. I think these letters shrunk since I wrote them. No, I need new eyes. Okay, so let's say if we talk about the conventional nature of the sprout, okay, it's the entity of a sprout that's found by a conventional consciousness comprehending. Maybe I do need more light. Oh, comprehending an object of knowledge that is a false, deceptive object. It's okay. Oh. Can't see anything now. Okay, the entity of a sprout that is found by a conventional consciousness comprehending an object of knowledge that is a false, deceptive object. That's the conventional. This is great, aren't they? That's the That's the conventional nature. Okay, now the ultimate truth is an object found by a reasoning consciousness perceiving or comprehending the meaning of reality. Okay? So, an object found by a reasoning consciousness perceiving the meaning of reality. That's what emptiness is. That's what an ultimate truth is. Okay? So, an ultimate truth, yeah, is something found by a reasoning consciousness that's looking for the deeper mode of existence. Okay? So, an ultimate truth is emptiness. Okay? Emptiness is... Okay. Emptiness exists in the way that it appears, in the sense that emptiness is also empty of an inherent existence, and it appears as empty. Okay, so when we say ultimate, emptiness is an ultimate truth. It's ultimate because it's this deeper mode of existence, and it is a truth in the sense that it does exist the way it appears. Okay, when you realize emptiness directly, everything else besides emptiness of inherent existence is a conventional truth because it doesn't exist the way it appears. It appears falsely to us. Okay, everything else we perceive appears inherently existent. It appears false. So that's why we say all the conventional phenomena are truths, are falsities. They're all falsities. Yeah? They're not true in the sense that they exist the way they appear, because they don't. They're false. Okay? But they're called conventional truths because for an obscured mind, in other words, an ignorant mind, they appear true to an ignorant mind. That doesn't mean that ignorance is a valid conventional cognizer that establishes the existence of these phenomena. Because ignorance is a misconception. Ignorance can't establish the existence of anything because the object that's grasped at by ignorance doesn't exist. Because what ignorance grasps at is inherently existent things. So ignorance is not the thing that establishes the existence of conventional truths. Okay? But conventional truths are so called because they appear true to an ignorant consciousness. Yeah? But it's just valid conventional cognizers that establish the existence of something. Like if my eye consciousness sees the flower, it sees a flower, you know, it labels flower, we all agree it's flower, that's a valid conventional cognition. It's, you know, it's known in the world, it's not contradicted by any other valid conventional cognition, okay? It's not, you know, the flower's just, you know, we agree, it's a flower, okay? But the flower that's appearing to me, okay, the way the flower is appearing to me, it's still appearing inherently existent to me. So the inherently existent flower doesn't exist. But there is a flower that is a nominally existent flower. There is a flower that's a dependent arising. And that flower does exist, and that appears incredibly, inseparably mixed in with the inherently existent flower. So when we have the appearance of flower, we have those two things completely mixed together, and we can't differentiate between what is the nominal flower that exists and what's the inherently existent flower that doesn't exist. Because especially the appearance of inherent existence is so powerful, you know, then the two appear just kind of completely mixed up. Okay? So the flower appears inherently existent. On top of that, my mind then assents to that appearance and says, yes, the flower is inherently existent. Okay? Now, there's a slight difference between when I just walk by and say there's a flower and when I have a lot of attachment to this flower, the way the flower appears to me is very different than when I just walk by and see a flower. Isn't it? Yeah? Because when I have attachment, all of a sudden, you know, I'm really grasping on to the inherent existence of this flower. There's a real flower out there, and I want it, and it has beauty and goodness and all these things in it. Okay? So you can see that just like on a normal day-to-day level, you know, when we just see things, they appear inherently existent to it, but we don't always grasp them as such when we're just, you know, I see a flower, I see a light. But sometimes when our mind gets really involved in these objects, it really grasps onto that appearance and really thinks, yes, you know. And we really, like when I broke somebody's glasses, you know, then the glasses are like real, aren't they, you know, to that person because they're now broken. Okay, so it's very, because we talk about ultimate truth, which are emptinesses, okay? And when we talk about emptiness, we sometimes talk about emptiness just saying emptiness as if it's one thing, but there's actually many different emptinesses, because there's the emptiness of the flower, there's the emptiness of the petals, there's the emptiness of the clock, okay? These things are all conceptually different, but when you're perceiving emptiness, all these emptinesses appear to your mind in the same way. Okay, but the basis of the emptiness, the flower, the clock, the petal, the glasses, these things all appear with their own individual characteristics. So those are conventional truths. You know, conventional truths have their own conventional characteristics. The flower's red, it has petals, it grows out of the ground. You know, the clock doesn't. Okay, the clock has other conventional characteristics that we identify it as a clock. But you know, if you have direct perception of the emptiness of the flower and direct perception of the emptiness of the clock, those two aren't going to appear differently to your mind because they're both the lack of inherent existence. Okay. Now, there's also two other terms here that are quite interesting. So we talked about ultimate truth and conventional truth. Now, there's things existing ultimately and things existing conventionally. Okay. This is different than ultimate truth and conventional truth because nothing exists ultimately and everything exists conventionally. Okay? So existing ultimately or ultimate existence means that you can find it upon analysis when you're using a reasoning consciousness analyzing the ultimate. When you use that realize that reasoning consciousness analyzing the ultimate, you know, nothing exists
that's there that you can find in a concrete way. So nothing exists ultimately. Even though emptiness is, you know, kind of the final product, emptiness doesn't exist ultimately. Emptiness also only exists conventionally. It's an ultimate truth, but it only exists conventionally. Why? Because emptiness also is only merely labeled. Emptiness doesn't have its own inherently existent nature. Emptiness is merely labeled. Okay? So everything that exists exists conventionally. But of all the things that exist conventionally, emptinesses are ultimate truths, and the rest of the phenomena are conventional truths. Okay? This kind of terminology is actually quite important when you start really getting into understanding emptiness. Okay, why don't we stop here? And then tomorrow we'll talk more about the second profundity. Maybe we'll get on to some of the other profundities. But I think you have enough to think about. Okay, so let's do the mantra a few times, and then just sit quietly for a moment.